The Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries has one approach to the carp conundrum. If you can't beat them, eat them. Next week, the state is in fact launching a campaign celebrating the gastro potential of the carp and giving it a new name, the silverfin. But how do you eat them? Well, that's where our next guest comes in handy. Chef Philippe Parola is working with the state to help people figure out how to cook the carp, and he joins us from Baton Rouge. Chef Parola, what does carp taste like? How would you describe it?
Well, number one, you know, carp is kind of misleading on that name because the carp that we know in Louisiana, the common carp, they are bottom feeder, and they taste good, but not as good as the silver carp, which we tried to rename it as a silver fin.
The silver fin, yeah.
Absolutely. The meat texture of it, it's a cross between scallops and crab meat. That's how good it is.
Now, the bones, though, I think are a problem, right? These are big fish with lots of bones. What do you do about that?
Absolutely, it's a lot of bones. The first thing first is about bleeding the fish. That fish have to be bled. It helped to get the meat really white. And secondly, on the bone, I found that if you steam the fish, you can remove the bone very easily. And then you take the end product of the steamed meat and do all kind of different things, such as fish cake and fish spread and soups and so on. I mean, you know, we know in Louisiana for our good cooking and a gumbo pot, you know, you can put literally almost anything there and it will taste good.
And these are big fish, so you're getting a big fillet out of this fish, I would guess.
Well, actually, believe it or not, this is one of the very few fish, the bigger you get, the better it is.
Huh.
Because the bones are bigger, you can remove them, but the fish quality of it stays the same.
I understand that you have had carp land in your boat. Is that right? They jump
Absolutely.
Out of the water and you've had
yeah.
a land right in there?
Well, actually, all of this started last August. I was doing a little work with Jeff Corwin from the Animal Planet, and he had a little cooking show on the Food Network called Extreme Cuisine, and he asked me to get an exotic fish out of Louisiana, so we went and get an alligator gar. And while I was riding a boat to catch that alligator gar, literally 40 minutes from New Orleans, these two giant carp just jumped in my boat and laid on my feet. Then I took this fish back to the restaurant, try them out.
So you're on this
yeah.
campaign. This is your mission, Ed,
well,
to turn this nuisance fish into
yeah,
a delicacy.
Yeah, absolutely. It is an invasive species, but it's domestic now. We have it.
And if I were to come to you today, Chef Parola, come in and to your kitchen and say, okay, convince me about this carp, this silverfin, make me something amazing, what would you cook for me? What would you serve?
All right. Well, I will tell you what. How long will it take to fry a fish nugget? 3 minutes?
I guess.
That's how long it will take to convince you. As soon as you're going to break that piece of fried fish, just fry it. That's it. And don't have to make a fancy sauce or anything else. It's that good. You don't have to cover it up with anything. You'll break it up. Wow.
Chef Parola, thanks for talking with us.
No problem. Thank you and bon appetit.
Chef Philippe Parola, he's helping Louisiana create a demand to eat the invasive Asian carp, otherwise known as the silverfin.
China is experiencing a resurgent interest in all things imperial. If you care to taste this fascination, there are restaurants in China that recreate imperial feasts, in which scores of exotic courses are served over several days. You may find the price astronomic, the authenticity questionable, and the animals on the menu too cute to eat. But as NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Beijing, the feast remains a legendary part of China's culinary culture.
The doors of a private room at the Cui Yuan restaurant swing open, and two waitresses in elaborate Manchu costumes bring in a first course for me to sample. A waitress explains that this soup was a favorite of the 18th century Manchu emperor Yongzheng. The little brown cubes in the soup, she points out, are deer's blood. Sun Xiaochun is the restaurant's head chef and vice chairman of the Chinese Culinary Association. His specialty is the Manhan Quanxi, or Manchu and Han Imperial Feast. Sun himself is an ethnic Manchu. His teacher's teacher, he explains, was a court chef at the Summer Palace in Chengde, a mountain resort town northeast of Beijing.
The Manchu emperors would spend the summers hunting and drilling troops at this summer retreat. This place produced a unique source of ingredients, cooking methods, and dishes.
Sun's menu is heavily populated with wild game. Next up on my plate is a deer's lip, soft and smooth with a chewy outside layer. After that, there's sea cucumber with swan goose meat, a rare waterfowl found in Manchuria. The swan goose tastes almost too light to be meat. I have to go ask the chef. In the kitchen, Chef Liu Yabin explains that the breast of the swan goose has been mashed into a puree, then formed into little white nuggets. That explains that. Back in the dining room, Sun says that his modern-day imperial feast is free of endangered species.
There are many ingredients we can no longer use, such as tiger meat. The imperial feast used to include a tiger's tail. Some rare species can now be raised on farms, such as hazel grouse, swan geese, deer, and mandarin ducks.
Now here's a bird I always thought I would appreciate for its appearance and not its taste. This is peacock stir-fried with hot peppers and peanuts. Well, I'd say it tastes like chicken, but it really doesn't. You can forget about getting a quick takeout from Sun's restaurant. His imperial feast contains 268 dishes, not including appetizers and desserts. His clients take up to a year to sample all 268, for which Sun charges them just over $54,000. For a dispassionate eye and palate on all this, I turn to Eileen Wen Mooney, author of the book Beijing Eats. She says Chinese imperial cuisine in general tends to be gimmicky and reliant on fancy presentation. She argues that locals order it more to impress guests than for the taste.
That's kind of misleading. People think Chinese people love to eat this kind of things. It's not like Chinese people really have this habit of loving exotic. You call it exotic in quotes. That doesn't represent what Chinese people like to eat.
As for claims of authenticity, Mooney says this is a moot point, as nobody alive today has tasted a real imperial feast. Chef Sun adds that while recipes for all 268 of his dishes can be found in imperial court cookbooks, imperial cuisine has evolved over centuries and it continues to do so today.
There may be some dishes which have lost their original taste. It may be the same dish with the same ingredients and the same name and the same preparation, but we have to improve it to satisfy modern people's tastes.
For all his compromises to contemporary tastes and wildlife laws, Sun seems to be doing well at preserving a tradition of what you might call imperial hubris of the culinary variety. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The company Monsanto dominates the seed business with a technology that's called Roundup Ready. Recently, the agriculture biotech company has been fending off charges that it's using the technology to kill off competitors. Monsanto counters that it's winning the market among farmers fair and square. Frank Morris of member station KCUR in Kansas City explains.
Even though deep snowdrifts cover his fields in eastern Kansas, Luke Ulrich, a corn and soybean farmer here, is thinking about spring. It's time to buy seed again, but hundreds of seed companies have gone under in the last two decades. Ulrich stands in the snow, remembering the days before genetically modified seeds upended the industry.
Ever since they've come out with the Roundup Ready trait and that became popular and basically took over farming, we've seen significant increases every single year.
Ulrich says his seed cost shot up almost 50% last year. Farmers face lawsuits if they try to save and plant GMO seed because they don't own the technology. While they bristle at that, they love Monsanto's Roundup Ready trait. With it, they can just douse their fields with a powerful weed killer and knock out everything they're not trying to grow.
There's nothing like Roundup. I mean, monkey could farm with it, you know.
More than 9 out of 10 soybean seeds carry the Roundup Ready trait. It's about the same for cotton and just a little lower for corn.
Farmers will not buy soybeans without Roundup Ready in it, so that gives Monsanto an amazing amount of leverage.
Jim Denver is a lawyer working for DuPont, which owns the competing seed company Pioneer. Pioneer licenses the Roundup Ready trait from Monsanto, as do about 150 other seed companies. Those agreements control what genetics competing companies can mix with the Roundup Ready trait. Last year, Monsanto sued to stop Pioneer from stacking Roundup Ready with another trait. Jim Denver says Pioneer complained to the Justice Department.
A seed company can't stay in business without offering seeds with Roundup Ready in it. So if they want to stay in that business, essentially they have to do what Monsanto tells them to do.
Monsanto's critics say it used this platform monopoly to crush many competitors. Chris Holman, a patent lawyer who teaches at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, likens it to Microsoft and its dominant Windows operating system.
Because of the structure of the industry, they are able to really drive participants in the industry into using their technology.
Monsanto spokesman Lee Quarles says those allegations are unfair, though he concedes they're coming at the company fast and furious.
We're actively working to address questions from regulators, both the Department of Justice as well as other state attorney generals, as well as other parties in the industry, to address any questions they have about our business.
But Monsanto is pushing ahead. It'll soon market a soybean seed combining 8 separate genetically engineered traits. Roundup Ready technology was developed at Monsanto's world headquarters in St. Louis. Vice President Jim Tobin says it sells itself.
Farmers get a chance to vote every year before they plant, and it's that vote each year that determines who has the largest market share or volume.
Monsanto spent huge amounts of money and took big risks to develop the Roundup Ready trait. Tobin says it's revolutionized agriculture. But now...
Well, we've invented something new.
Yep. It's called Roundup Ready to Yield. It uses the same gene as the original, just placed in a different spot in the genome. Monsanto claims it boosts yield. Interesting timing, Monsanto's patent on Roundup Ready 1 expires in 2014, and with it, a revenue stream of maybe $500 million a year in royalties. That's unless it can switch farmers over to Roundup Ready 2.
Would like to have everyone that is in the soybean business, seed business, using the trait.
Monsanto's putting the new trait in all its best soybean seeds. And Paul Schickler says it's forcing its licensees to do the same. Schickler's the president of Pioneer. He charges that Monsanto is trying to make Roundup Ready 1 disappear.
That's our concern, bridging or switching from one patented product, Roundup Ready 1, to the next generation, Roundup Ready to Yield, doesn't allow generic competition for the initial technology.
Unlike in many other industries, there's no clear path for a genetically modified crop to go generic. As it stands, generic providers would probably still need access to Monsanto's proprietary data to get federal approval to sell the Roundup Ready trait. They'd also need closely held technical information to update licenses that keep the trait legal in big, important markets like China and the EU. Meanwhile, the end of the Roundup Ready patent will likely give farmers a chance to do something they haven't done in years, plant seed they've harvested. Luke Ulrich is ready.
Because I don't care how good Roundup Ready 2 is, if you tell me I can save back my own seed, I'm going to plant my own seed.
The problem for guys like Ulrich will be in finding seed that has just the Roundup Ready gene alone, not one stacked with other patented traits. After all, if you can't find the seed in the first place, you can't grow it. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.